This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons in Washington. America endured a tragic week of the COVID-19 pandemic. The death toll has reached more than 16,000 deaths nationwide as doctors, nurses, and first responders and others courageously care for patients. Each evening, people across the country pay tribute to those working on the front lines. From balconies, driveways, porches, and sidewalks, thousands clap, bang pots, and howl each night to thank and honor the healthcare workers risking their lives each day. This is what it sounds like in New York, the hardest hit city in the nation. And in Atlanta, Georgia. And Denver, Colorado, where people howl. And Long Beach, California. These are some of the moving tributes to healthcare workers heard around the nation each evening. It's the News Roundup. Joining us to talk about the week's top national stories as the pandemic grips the nation, Wendy Benjaminson. She's a politics editor at Bloomberg News. Wendy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Karl is the chief White House correspondent for ABC News and the author of the new book, Front Row at the Trump Show. Jonathan, thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
And Kimberly Adams is a host and correspondent at Marketplace. Kimberly, welcome back to 1A.
Thank you.
Normally, our roundup guests would be here in studio with me, but because of social distancing, of course, they are all remote and they're joining us safely from their homes. Jumping right in, the death toll from COVID-19 is rising in the U.S. More than 16,000 people have died so far across the country. But Dr. Anthony Fauci says there is a glimmer of hope. This week, he lowered his total death toll estimate from upwards of 240,000 to 60,000. Wendy, I'll start with you. What do we know about how well this social distancing and the stay-at-home orders are actually helping?
Yes, well, they seem to be helping tremendously. I mean, if Dr. Fauci, who is very trusted on this issue, if he is right that he can cut the that grim death toll in half, projected by having us all stay at home, then it really is working. I think the issue will be the very tricky question will be when we can all leave our homes and go back to some semblance of normal life. Because, of course, the White House is taking the political ramifications into effect. And if we all go back to work and the virus rises up again, I think America is going to be very angry at the government for that.
Jonathan, what's the latest on how long we'll be all told to stay at home?
Well, at the White House, there is a growing feeling and desire to see a loosening once this 30-day period of the CDC guidelines and social distancing expire. That would be April 30th. There's a real desire, particularly among the particularly from the president himself and his economic advisors, to start seeing an opening, beginning in the start of May. Obviously, the big question is whether or not that is possible. And this flattening of the curve we have seen, this clear success of containing this through social distancing, whether or not that would just kind of lifting that would result in a massive increase back in the other direction. That's the danger. That's the concern. But I can tell you, at least at the White House, they are really looking at that May 1st date.
But we are also learning about a stark racial disparity in hospitalization rates. According to NPR, African Americans make up a third of hospitalizations, despite only accounting for 13% of the U.S. population.
Health disparities have always existed for the African American community. But here again, with the crisis, how it's shining a bright light on how unacceptable that is, because yet again, when you have a situation like the coronavirus, they are suffering disproportionately. As Dr. Berg said correctly, it's not that they're getting infected more often. It's that when they do get infected, their underlying medical conditions, the diabetes, the hypertension, the obesity, the asthma, those are the kind of things that wind them up in the ICU and ultimately give them a higher death rate. So when all this is over, and as we've said, it will end, we will get over coronavirus, but there will still be health disparities, which we really do need to address in the African-American community.
Kimberly, what else do we know about who's being affected most and why?
I think the underlying health care disparities are crucial, not only in terms of these underlying conditions that Dr. Fauci was talking about, but also in terms of access to health care. You see Black and brown people in the United States having, you know, much less access to health care. And so that kind of exacerbates those underlying conditions. And might also, because it's still not entirely clear to most people who might pay for your medical bills if you have to go to the hospital,
it's
also harder for many people to go get care because they're afraid of that debt. At the same time, the people who aren't able to social distance, the people who are still out making deliveries, working in restaurants so that they can make the food, working at grocery stores and stocking and working in the Amazon factories, many and other factories and stocking facilities, a lot of these people do tend to be disproportionately Black and brown people and are at higher risk of exposure. And so we're seeing all of these sort of underlying themes bubble up and turn out in these terrible numbers that you see with a much higher death rate for people who are Black and brown.
And Kimberly, your thoughts on this tweet here. We have a tweet from Jen. She says, "The hardest hit minority population is not being covered by the national news media, Native Americans."
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely a devastating story. I've been seeing a lot of reports coming from various Native American communities about, you know, the astonishing rate of infection. Again, you see these things with lack of access to health care, lack of ready access to treatment. If you think about how some of these communities are laid out, often it is a very, very far trip to even get to a hospital with an ICU facility. And so I think all of these things are making this even worse for various minority communities. And yeah, you're seeing crazy numbers in Native American communities.
We also got new jobless numbers Wednesday. Another 6.6 million people filed for unemployment benefits last week, nearly matching the record that was set the week before that. More than 16 million have filed for unemployment in the past 3 weeks. What does this mean for the economy, Kimberly?
It's not good. And also what it means for people's lives. I mean, we at Marketplace talk so much about sort of what the economic trends are. But it's also, as I'm sure everybody listening knows, this is what's showing up in people's lives. Just at this point, pretty much all of us know somebody who has lost their job as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. One out of every 10 Americans has, you know, is out of work because of this. And so we're seeing this show up in lots of different ways. The absolute surge of people rushing to try to file for unemployment, the systems crashing because they can't handle the onslaught, food banks struggling to suddenly provide, food for people, and schools that have shut down trying to convert themselves into grocery stores. Not to mention, you know, small businesses, people who've put their life savings into starting up a restaurant or a little shop or something, just really coming to terms with the fact that even if they can get, you know, some aid from the federal or local government, will they really be able to stay open? And so when we hear these conversations about the economic effects of this pandemic, there are the big numbers that are kind of hard to wrap your head around. And then there's what we see, you know, every day in people's lives.
Wendy, can unemployment programs support this surge?
So far, they're showing that they are very, very, very strained. The trouble is that they need people to come in and work. Many of them in the more rural states have systems, and even in densely populated states, have systems that still work on paper. You still have to show up and fill out a paper form and hand it to a clerk, and then a paper check has to be issued. And during this pandemic, when the workforce has shrunk and the lines for unemployment are so long, it is really, really straining the systems. And the ones that do have computer systems are crashing from the overuse. Mm-hmm. So that is just making a bad situation worse, I'm afraid.
And many of the newly unemployed, as Kimberly mentioned a moment ago, are turning to food banks for supplies. At least some of those are struggling to meet increased demand. Quickly tell us more about that, Jonathan.
Well, I mean, it's heartbreaking. You see massive lines. You see lines of cars waiting to get into food banks. You see struggling to meet a need. People find themselves going to food banks who have never had to do that before, even thought about that possibility. So there is a struggle. I see, you know, there's a philanthropic effort to donate to food banks, but it is an overwhelming need. And when you look at the jobless numbers, I mean, the turnaround is just staggering and hard to get your mind around. We had historically low unemployment rates at the beginning of the year, less than 4%. Now, you know, as you mentioned, 1 in 10, 10% unemployment rate, probably heading to 15. The 6.6 million people in just this week filing for jobless claims. But then look at the last 3 weeks, and you're up nearly 17 million people. And that means, you know, people losing health insurance who had insurance for their job, and it means people unable to buy food for their families.
We're speaking with Wendy Benjaminson at Bloomberg News, Jonathan Carl with ABC News, and Kimberly Adams with Marketplace. We've lost so many talented performers and musicians in the past few weeks. We wanted to note that the up-and-coming young rapper and model, Chyna, she died this week in Philadelphia from a drug overdose. She was only 25 years old. More from you and our guests in a moment. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as isolation, depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment when you need professional help. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
In Cherokee Nation, a feud has been simmering for more than 180 years.
I always joke that the Ridges and the Rosses were like the Montagues and the Capulets. We've been fighting for so long that people don't really know why, but in Cherokee, we know why.
That's next week on Code Switch from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We're talking about the week's top national news with Wendy Benjaminson at Bloomberg News, Jonathan Carl with ABC News, and Kimberly Adams with Marketplace. Now, as the impact of the coronavirus continues to grow, President Trump shifts the blame. The president fired two inspectors general within a week of each other, while publicly threatening another. He's also threatened to pull funding from the World Health Organization because of its handling of the pandemic. Wendy, can you explain these attacks a bit more, and are they justified?
Well, it's for the American public to decide if they're justified or not, but the attack seemed to be holding to the pattern we've all become quite familiar with. And Jonathan, I'm stepping onto your beat here, but, you know, when Donald Trump feels like he's backed into a corner, whether he backed himself into the corner or not, he comes out swinging at anything. And he still feels very bruised by the impeachment, and he feels that that inspector general from the intelligence community that he fired for turning over the whistleblower's complaint to Congress, which I think was the man's job to do, you know, and other inspectors general, anyone who crosses him becomes an enemy, becomes someone he is distrustful of, and someone who needs to go. He is getting some backing, I saw this morning, from Attorney General William Barr in doing that, which, you know, the problem is that our government is built on a system of checks and balances, and every action must be checked by someone else in the government. And these inspectors general are independent of politics. They are not chosen by partisan means. Their personal politics are unknown to, I presume, everyone they work with and everyone in the public. And so they are supposed to take a clean, cold-eyed look at what's going on and decide if it's kosher or not, for lack of a better word. And if they decide it's not, that should be it. But, you know, President Trump, of course, sees everything as a personal affront.
Mary on Facebook says, please note how governors are leading us, not President Trump. Jonathan, how would you characterize the president's response this week as the messaging and tone out of the White House continues to change?
Well, the president, as he always is is consumed with how he is being perceived, and specifically how he is being perceived and portrayed in the news media. And it enrages him to see any sense, any portrayal of his responses not being adequate, of taking any blame for missteps. This makes him upset. If a governor mentions a concern, we've seen him lash out at the governors of Michigan and Washington State, and occasionally lock horns with Andrew Cuomo, unless Andrew Cuomo comes out and praises him. And I've been on these calls. I went with him when he went to FEMA the other day and did a video conference call with governors. And it's striking how the governors, almost to a person, begin their comments by offering words of praise for President Trump. And this is Democrats as well as Republicans. Now, part of this is we're all in this together. We need to work on this. We need federal assistance. But part of it is, frankly, massaging the president's ego. He needs the affirmation. I've seen it in the briefing room. I go to those briefings, right. And the questions he lashes out almost on a daily basis against some reporter. Sometimes it's me. Sometimes it's my right. colleagues. Mm-hmm. Lashing out at any question that suggests that there was some misstep in the federal response. Let's face it, there's been a lot of missteps, as you would expect in a crisis of this size. There are going to be missteps, and there have been very clear missteps.
Bob emails from Chicago. How can you say social distancing is working when inadequate testing still exists in most parts of the country? We don't know if it's working. What do you say, Jonathan?
Well, look, the social distancing is clearly has clearly worked to slow the growth and the spread of this disease. And the scary thing is, what happens when the restrictions are loosened? Does the so-called flattening of the curve reverse itself? And we just don't know. If you go back and you look at the trends during the Spanish flu of 1918, it came back with a vengeance in the fall. The maximum death rate was actually in October, not in the spring. So I think we're going to face a very difficult challenge here as a nation when we get to the point of deciding, are we going to start going back to normal? I've asked Dr. Fauci about this, and he has said, look, we will not be back to normal, maybe not ever, but not until there is a vaccine that has been developed and safely tested and available to everybody, which, of course, could be a year and a half from now. That doesn't mean you can't do loosening between now and then, but life in America is going to be different for a long, long time.
Now, Congress clashed over emergency aid funding for small businesses that would have provided $250 billion in funding for small business loans. Kimberly, the White House pushed lawmakers to quickly pass the aid. What happened?
Well, Democrats basically said, let's tap the brakes for just a second because we still haven't spent the last round of money for small businesses, or at least gotten it out of the door. It's important to keep this in context. That last bailout that we had, or stimulus package, I should say, that we had, had a ton of money for small businesses in it. First come, first serve, real struggle on the rollout, banks trying to get guidance and maybe deciding whether or not they were even going to do it. We had tons of stories of businesses waiting on hold or getting busy signals for days at a time as they were trying to get this funding. So that money is almost 100% going to be spent very quickly. But it's not out the door yet. And so what Democrats are arguing is, while we have a little bit of a window and we're still trying to distribute these funds, let's negotiate over the parameters of this next round of funding. So Democrats want to add additional money beyond that $250 billion for hospitals and for clinics and to get a bit more money to states and things like that. Now, the Republicans are arguing, look, we need no delays whatsoever. This money needs to get out there because that first round is going to run out. So Democrats trying to negotiate a bit longer on this, and obviously the White House and particularly the Republicans in the Senate pushing just to move forward.
Let's move forward to the 2020 presidential race. A big moment this week. Bernie Sanders dropped out of the race, making way for Joe Biden as the Democratic nominee. He live-streamed his announcement ending his presidential bid.
I wish I could give you better news, but I think you know the truth. And that is that we are now some 300 delegates behind Vice President Biden, and the path toward victory is virtually impossible. So while we are winning the ideological battle, and while we are winning the support of so many young people and working people throughout the country, I have concluded that this battle for the Democratic nomination will not be successful. And so today, I am announcing the suspension of my campaign.
Jonathan, are you surprised that Bernie ended his campaign? And tell us what this means for the Democratic Party this election.
Well, it would be surprising if not for the crisis. Bernie Sanders, I've known him well for a long time. I covered his campaign 4 years ago, covered again this year. This is a candidate that would have gone right into the convention, would have taken it, would have amassed every single delegate that he could get to come to the convention to pursue not just his own candidacy for president, but his agenda. He is leading, he sees himself as leading a revolution in American politics, not simply running for president as an individual. So if not for this, trust me, Bernie Sanders would not have suspended his campaign. But I think what he saw was the danger of people going to the polls and voting during this time, and the disaster that we saw unfold in Wisconsin. This was an extraordinary move for Bernie Sanders, but really one that he could not avoid given the crisis.
Wendy, what are the challenges that Biden will face in reuniting this party?
Well, he is going to face some challenges, and you can see him beginning to address it almost immediately. Bernie Sanders drops out. He does say that he will continue to remain on ballots where he is on the ballot and continue to amass delegates so that he can do just what Jonathan just said, which is to influence the party platform and to influence Joe Biden and maybe influence the vice presidential pick. So he still wants to be a voice in the party, and it's a voice that doesn't agree with Vice President Biden on a lot of things. So that will be a major challenge for Biden. What Biden has done in just the last 24 hours is adopted even more minor step policy proposals that are a little more in line with Sanders. For example, he will not embrace Medicare for all, at least not now. He will not embrace the Green New Deal, not now. He is, however, agreeing to propose lowering the eligibility age for Medicare from 65 to 60, and that is in response to the virus. People will need, who are out of work, who are older, who can't get back to work, will need Medicare. And he is also broadening his free college tuition. It's still means tested, which Sanders was not, but he is widening that as a way to reach the more liberal voters. In the end, his argument is going to be, however, I will handle this crisis better than Donald Trump, which is the only issue that really matters right now. Who is better positioned to get us out of this mess?
Well, Kimberly, you heard what Wendy just said. Any early thoughts from you on a Biden versus Trump general election showdown?
I think it's kind of fascinating. It's almost the opposite of a traditional presidential race. Usually you make it through the primary and then your candidate moves a little bit more towards the center after appealing to the far right, further right or further left in the primary. And in this situation, you have Biden actually moving a little bit to the left after sort of securing the nomination. The voting situation come November is going to be very interesting in the midst of this pandemic. You know, will states and local governments expand their vote by mail policies? Are they going to broaden their absentee voting rules? And I think that's going to be one of the debates that's coming up in the coming months.
Now, let's talk about California, a state that was hit hard at the beginning of the outbreak in the U.S. California Governor Gavin Newsom said this week his state will secure 200 million face masks, enough face masks to meet the need of California and potentially other states. Here he is on The Rachel Maddow Show on MSNBC.
We were going out getting 5 million here, 500,000 there, 200,000 there, competing against other states, competing against the federal government. We decided enough of the small ball. Let's use our purchasing power. Let's go at scale. And we built a consortium of nonprofits and a large manufacturer with appropriate contacts in Asia. And now we have the confidence that 150 plus million N95 masks, 50 plus million surgical masks will come in on a monthly basis starting in the next few weeks.
Kimberly, what could this deal with California mean for the West Coast?
Well, it's interesting that the governor is planning these aren't just for healthcare workers. These are also for, you know, grocery store clerks, homeless outreach teams, and other people who are sort of out in the – who still have to work, who are still providing these essential services. And, you know, in the social media bubble of Washington, the joke that went around about this sort of consortium of states working together to order – emergency supplies was that, gee, if we only had another gathering of all the states together to operate as one, what could that look like? You know, as a joke related to the United States of America. And calling out the criticisms, basically, that the federal government is not having a unified response to procure and distribute these emergency supplies. California taking the lead on this. It's in. It'll be fascinating to see what this means for the supply chain, because as these states are bidding against each other and countries are bidding against the states, and we've had some reports of the federal government bidding against the states, does this just create one more way to raise the cost of these supplies? Is this just going to amplify that issue? And we're still waiting to see.
Jonathan, what does this mean that states are having to get personal protection equipment on their own without the help of the federal government?
Well, it's fascinating to listen to Gavin Newsom talk about California as a nation state. He's actually used that phrase. He's using their purchasing power as a nation state to compile all this personal protective equipment. And then he's even also he's talked about the idea of exporting it from California. Now, California is one of the 50 states. So it's not a separate nation state. It doesn't export to other states. But that's what he's had to do, because there has been frustration. Despite the self-congratulations that we hear every day at those White House briefings, there has been a real problem getting that equipment out to the states. The coordinated federal response has not been coordinated. You have several entities at various points in this crisis that have taken the lead on it, leaving many of the governors confused about who to deal with. So on one hand, you had HHS and Pence is kind of the key points here. Then Jared Kushner set up his operation. Peter Navarro has told, I know for a fact, has told major manufacturers, I'm your main contact here, deal with me. And then, of course, FEMA, which is supposed to be doing the distribution now. It's all left not just the states confused, but also the manufacturers, the companies that make this equipment, who are eager to try to get what they already have in production. This is not even a matter of, in some cases, of ramping up production, but of getting material that has already been made out to those who need it. The response has not been coordinated, and that's why you see Gavin Newsom saying, you know what, we're going to act as if we are the United States of California.
We are talking about the week's top national news with Jonathan Karl with ABC News, Wendy Benjaminson at Bloomberg News, and Kimberly Adams with Marketplace. More from our guests and from you in a moment. Now, as we take a pause, we want to take a note that the legendary singer-songwriter John Prine died this week from coronavirus. Listener Mesa Siebert from Minneapolis, Minnesota, sent us this tribute to Prine. She remembers seeing him in Duluth, Minnesota last summer.
There was a moment where he was playing and his band was playing, and he took his guitar off and laid it on the stage and proceeded to dance around it on the ground. And then he danced his way off the stage and out the door while his band continued to play the song. And it was a really beautiful moment that keeps playing in my mind, because it would be the last time I'd see John Prine. And it was, to me, even in that moment, like he was saying goodbye. And that beauty and that simplicity is something I found in a lot of his music.
Thanks, Mesa, for sharing that moving tribute. Here's some of John Prine himself singing Hello in There. More from our guests and from you in a moment. Stay with us.
Grow wilder every day. Old people just grow lonesome, waiting for someone to say hello in there. Hello.
When the economy goes haywire and you need a podcast to turn to, Planet Money is here for you.
Are we already in a recession?
There's no question that we are about to enter a period of substantial slowdown in the economy.
Listen to NPR's Planet Money, emergency podcasts whenever the news demands it.
We're back. We're talking with the about the week's top national news stories with Wendy Benjaminson at Bloomberg News, Jonathan Carl at ABC News, and Kimberly Adams with Marketplace. Now, the Navy has had its fair share of problems since the onset of the coronavirus outbreak, but now the service is without a leader. Acting Navy Secretary Thomas Modley removed the captain of the USS Theodore Roosevelt last week after the captain sent a memo criticizing the Navy's response to crew members of the aircraft carrier contracting the virus. Modley's response that the captain was, quote, too naive or too stupid to be commanding officer of a ship like this, that was not received well, leading to his resignation Tuesday. Wendy, Modley resigned on his own terms, but how big was the push for him to be removed?
I was going to push back a little bit on resigned on his own terms. I think he had no choice but to resign at that point. I mean, Donald Trump, the president had said that he was going to look into it after first, defending Modley or saying he didn't know him. I think there were all three responses. Yeah. And then the defense secretary had demanded that Modley apologize. So at that point, you know, in Washington, you really don't have much choice but to draft a letter of resignation and maybe hope it's rejected, which it wasn't in this point. I think, you know, the issue with the ship and the Navy secretary and the captain is that the captain was obviously extremely frustrated and extremely frightened about the fate of his crew. That's his job, to be worried about the fate of his crew. That's entirely, in a nutshell, his job. Mm-hmm. The trouble is, in the military, he went outside the chain of command. He put a public letter to 30 people, unclassified, easily leaked, and he embarrassed the Navy. In that culture, you are not supposed to do that. You are not supposed to go outside of the chain of command. So they disciplined him. They removed him as captain of the ship. He was still in the Navy. He was still a captain. He was just going to be reassigned. And then Modley just seemed to throw gasoline on this fire by going to the ship and very inappropriately saying to this captain's crew, his sailors, that, you know, he was naive and stupid. And that was just the bridge too far.
In an address on Tuesday, President Trump said that Modley's resignation was a, quote, selfless action, and had this to say about the captain's actions.
I hate seeing bad things happen. Man made a mistake. But, you know, you shouldn't be writing letters, and you're in the military. You're the captain of a great ship, and you shouldn't be writing letters and sending them to many people. And then it gets out to the media.
Jonathan, was Captain Brett Crozier's memo a cry for help or an act of defiance?
Well, you can just look at how it was received by the Navy, by the sailors that he was serving with. He left that ship as a hero. You saw the video of him coming out being applauded. It was clearly a cry for help. Now, it's exactly right. That is not the military culture to send out a note like that, a memo like that broadly. The president has clearly implied that Captain Crozier even leaked it to the news media. I mean, who knows whether that happened or whether it was one of the 30-plus that he sent the memo to. But regardless, it was clearly a cry for help that coronavirus had taken over the Roosevelt. He needed help. He didn't feel like he was getting it from his immediate superiors. And, he crossed a line, perhaps, but it was a line that was crossed in the service of his sailors. And that's why you saw him treated as a hero. The president was quite critical of him in the beginning, even suggested that the coronavirus outbreak may have been his fault because of a stop that he had made. I mean, a captain of a ship like that does not decide where it is going. He follows orders on that. It was, you know, in many ways, you could argue that the president himself slandered Captain Crozier during this process, but the Navy Secretary, he had to resign. I mean, he took that trip to Guam that speech was extraordinary, not only in terms of the personal attacks on the captain, but it was laced with profanity. It was really quite quite a speech. And by the way, it was a 35-hour round-trip visit to Guam that cost taxpayers $250,000.
Yikes!
So I think there was no chance that he was going to continue on as Navy Secretary.
Before we move on, I just want to make a minor clarification of something I mentioned earlier. I mentioned we discussed that Trump has removed two inspector generals from their posts. The intelligence inspector general, Michael Atkinson, was actually fired, and the Defense Department inspector general was not fired. So I just want to make sure that was clear. He was removed from his role overseeing the pandemic relief oversight. Now, New York is still home to the most COVID-19 cases in the U.S. More than 159,000 people have tested positive there. And Thursday marked a record number of deaths, 799 in one day.
I lived through 9/11. 9/11 was supposed to be the darkest day in New York for a generation. We've done everything we can since 9/11 to make sure 9/11 didn't happen again. We lose 2,753 lives on 9/11. We've lost over 7,000 lives to this crisis. That is so shocking and painful and breathtaking. I don't even have the words for it.
That was New York Governor Andrew Cuomo in a press briefing on Thursday. Wendy, tell us more about what's going on in New York right now.
Well, it is, they are having one horrible day after another. And the spirit that you referred to at the beginning of the show with them coming out and cheering the healthcare workers just sort of shows the spirit of that city. It is not a city that gets knocked on its heels very often or easily.
They are tough, yes.
They are tough. But, you know, the trouble is that New Yorkers also, like many of us, want to remove ourselves from the danger areas, and they are going to places like the Jersey Shore and Long Island and Connecticut and Rhode Island and Florida, and that is those who can, of course. That's probably 1% of New Yorkers. But that is making it difficult for other states to try to contain the virus as well. So it's it can't ever be seen as just one city suffering.
Mm-hmm. And New Jersey being right behind New York with more than 50,000 cases. What are its leaders doing to curb the spread, Wendy?
Well, Governor Phil Murphy has, issued the stay-at-home orders. He is trying to discourage people from New York from going to their beach houses in Jersey or other places. Strict orders. He's moved the presidential primary. He saw what happened in Wisconsin this week and decided to move the primary to late June. These will have to probably be moved again. But, you know, he is taking this all the steps a governor can take.
And we know that prisons are one place the virus spreads very quickly. Chicago's Cook County Jail has one of the largest outbreaks with 350 cases in a little over 2 weeks, according to the New York Times. Kimberly, what's being done about outbreaks like that?
Well, in some states and communities, they are trying to release some prisoners that are they determined to be low risk for whatever community that's in. Actually, WBEZ in Chicago was reporting that a federal judge denied that the Cook County Jail actually needed to release all of its prisoners given the outbreak there after civil rights attorneys have asked that more and more of those prisoners be released. So there are definitely challenges there. I think Rikers Island is putting all of its population in individual cells and sort of cracking down on communal spaces, which is, you know, can make that life even harder within a prison. But if you think about it, like a nursing home in some ways, this is almost a petri dish for an outbreak like this, where you don't necessarily have a lot of space between people. And when you don't have sort of freedom of movement within that space, it can even exacerbate some of those things. So you have a lot of cases, a lot of civil rights concerns, and activists are complaining and trying to get more people released. But at the same time, there's a public safety concern that local leaders are having to face all over the country.
Now, switching gears, we like to take some time at the end of the Friday news roundups to give our journalists a chance to tell us stories that they've been thinking about or what they've been working on, or even stories that they think might not be on our radar but should be. Jonathan, I would love to actually use this time to talk about your new book, Front Row at the Trump Show. The president called you fake news, and he said, "That's why you're going nowhere." And you two go way back, of course. You met back in the 90s when you were a new reporter at the New York Post and Trump was a property developer at the time. Tell us, what are some of the themes and the revelations that are in your book that can help us, help inform us, really, about how the White House is handling this pandemic crisis?
Well, first off, I wrote this book because I've had a series of extraordinary experiences with Donald Trump. First, as you mentioned, dating back to 1994 when I first met him and did a story with him, and like an off-the-rails, crazy story when you consider what happened, two decades later, right, getting to the White House. And these experiences that I've had, what I've witnessed going back and reporting on some of the major events of the Trump era, mm-hmm, really gives insight into how he operates, and especially his relationship with the news media, which he so relentlessly attacks, but also relentlessly courts, mm-hmm, and tries to get attention. And he has actually very extensive relations with members of the news media. And, you know, me, I've known him longer than any, but my colleagues, Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, who he attacks relentlessly, but actually has very eagerly courted, and I know respects. Mm-hmm. I think it gives insights into how he is handling this crisis, how he sees it. He, above all, wants to, you know, sees this as an opportunity to be seen as in charge and in command, and that's why he is so, mm-hmm, outraged when he sees any criticism or any sense that he has blame for things that have gone wrong.
So, Jonathan, you know, so many books out there about Trump. Tell us what specifically you want readers to take away from your book.
First and foremost, I want you to get a sense by reading this book of what it is like to be there, to be covering this White House, to have covered Donald Trump as a candidate, to understand how he operates 20, 30, 50 years from now. If somebody wants to ask the question, what was that Trump thing all about? What was that Trump era all about? I hope somebody will hand my book, and it, mm-hmm, will give you insight into how he operates and what he's done. I tell stories in this book that I've never told before in the crush of day-to-day reporting on, and it has been a crush of, yeah, of news reporting on this White House and the campaign leading into this White House. About a third of the book is before he gets to the White House. These are stories that I could not tell. I got people like John Kelly, who would talk to me quite often off the record while he was chief of staff, to give me permission to write about those off-the-record conversations. It's far more revealing than what you can see in the kind of day-to-day craziness that comes out of the White House.
Wendy, you've been doing a lot of in-depth reporting on the struggles of the unemployed to file those claims. Quickly, what advice do you have for people who are having trouble filing?
Oh, I... advice ever to be patient and try, just keep trying to work through it. Complain to your congressman, complain to, you know, the workforce commission in your state, whatever it's called, and try to get through. This is your money. It's taken out of your paycheck every 2 weeks, yeah, and it needs to come back to you as quickly as possible.
Kimberly, you've been reporting about how technology is aiding mental health care in nursing homes. Will we see more of that reporting in the future?
I think we're going to see more reporting on that because it's going to have to become more common. I mean, nursing, yeah, homes also a hotbed of this infection. And as staff, you know, are concerned for their own health, they're going to have to start relying on more telehealth. But some of those jobs just cannot be done remotely.
And you'll be following the racial disparities we talked about earlier as well?
For sure. And also not just the racial disparities, but sort of the renewed attention on these lower-income workers who are newly known as being essential. You know, we have these rounds of applause for grocery store workers, but does that mean that when we come out of this that people are going to treat them with more respect? Are they going to get better health benefits and better pay? And so will this sort of newly found acknowledgement that many of these lower-wage workers are crucial for the running of the economy, and when I say newly discovered, I mean among certain people who may, yeah, have dismissed it in the past, because they have always been essential for the economy. Will that translate into more political and social will to change the way that our society relates to the benefits for these folks?
That's the week's top national news stories with Kimberly Adams, host and correspondent at Marketplace, Jonathan Carl, chief White House correspondent for ABC News and author of the new book, Front Row at the Trump Show, and Wendy Benjaminson, politics editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you all. We're going to take a quick break before going into the international section of our news roundup. And while we do that, let's listen to a song from Hal Wilner. He was a music producer best known for melding different musical styles and blurring the lines between genres. He died this week in New York at the age of 64. He had symptoms consistent with the coronavirus. 1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Ben Privett and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. Stay with us for the international section of our news roundup right after this. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons in Washington. Hundreds of millions of people turned out on balconies and in backyards around the world to cheer on healthcare workers battling coronavirus. But some medical workers have been getting not cheers, but verbal and sometimes physical abuse. By now, many nations around the world have implemented some kind of shelter-in-place order. Let's check in on how the world is handling coronavirus in ways that are good and not so good. Indira Lakshmanan is National Geographic's senior executive editor. Indira, always a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Sasha.
Ishan Tharoor covers foreign affairs for The Washington Post. Ishan, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be back.
And Abdirahim Fukara is chief of Al Jazeera's U.S. Bureau. Abdirahim, welcome.
Great to be with you, Sasha.
The world hit a grim milestone this week, folks. We surpassed 1.5 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, and we're quickly approaching 100,000 coronavirus deaths. Indira, start us off. Can you give us the global picture here? What parts of the world experienced the most dramatic jump in coronavirus cases this week?
Well, the United States is continuing to lead the pack with almost 17,000 coronavirus deaths out of 463,000 and counting cases. So we're accounting for almost one third of those global coronavirus cases you were talking about. It's stunning to see it, and a good place to look at it is Johns Hopkins University is tracking all of this, and on their website you can see it. Spain is close behind us, which is startling because it's a much smaller country. So they have twice as many deaths per 100,000 people as we have experienced, and Italy behind them. But what we've started seeing is a rise in coronavirus cases in other places, which are, you know, slower to where the virus was slower to come. So an uptick in Russia, in India, in Niger, in Peru, in places that, you know, have not been heavily, badly hit so far. Mm-hmm. And one thing that really concerns me, of course, is the moment that the coronavirus gets into, you know, large slums and developing countries, it's not even going to be possible to count the bodies. Many of these people will never make it to the hospital, and their deaths will never be counted as coronavirus deaths. The same thing, we saw a case in Yemen today, which has been ravaged by civil war for so many years. If that spreads in Yemen, I think it's going to be really hard to keep track of the cases at that point.
Abderrahim, where in the world is the spread of the virus actually slowing down?
Italy seems, which obviously was the focus of attention worldwide after China.
Right.
The numbers of deaths seem to be, if not going down, at least the number seems to be stabilizing. Spain, as we just heard, has basically overtaken Italy. I was talking to a Brit yesterday, and we were comparing between the United Kingdom and Italy. And he seems to think that the United Kingdom, despite all the precautions taken by the government there, seems to be that it could probably be where Italy was 2-3 weeks ago. But he said that because there isn't enough testing, it's hard to know. But the figures actually point in the direction of a worrying situation.
Yeah.
There are places in other parts of the world, namely the Middle East, where it's really hard to gauge the exact reality of what the virus is doing. Because many of the governments in the region, either they do not have the wherewithal to actually track the progress of the virus, or they are worried about transparency creating more political problems for them. But there's obviously a lot of worry in that part of the world, not just because of war in Yemen, but because also there are a lot of refugees. And in many parts of North Africa and the Middle East, people do not have the financial means to actually deal with the lockdowns that come with the coronavirus. So in many parts of the world, like we're seeing in Egypt, for example, people continue to crowd the streets trying to earn a living to feed their families and their children.
A fight broke out this week between the group leading the international response to the coronavirus pandemic and the person leading the American one. Over the course of 3 days, President Trump called the World Health Organization China-centric. He announced the U.S. would stop funding the organization and then reverse the course. Here's Trump on Wednesday talking about that U.S. funding and comparing it to China's aid.
$452 million compared to $42 million. That's to the World Health Organization. That's not good. That's not good. Not fair. Not fair at all. And other countries, as you know, also gave very substantially less than the United States. And the world, WHO, World Health, got it wrong. I mean, they got it very wrong. In many ways, they were wrong. They also minimized the threat very strongly, and not good.
How did the WHO respond to Trump's criticisms, Indira?
Look, the WHO, which is a, you know, international body, a UN-affiliated body, defended itself. And, you know, they make the point that, by the way, the United States wrote many of the rules that govern the World Health Organization. And, you know, some of our listeners may remember that some of this came out of the SARS crisis back in 2003, which originated in China. I was based in China as a reporter at the time. And because of the fears of this pandemic, which at that point didn't travel quite as far around the world as COVID has, there were new rules written about how countries who are members of the WHO have to make transparent any kind of disease pandemic that could possibly cross over their borders, and then become a pandemic. And in those rules, it was said that countries then would not have to impose a travel ban, but they could if they wanted to. So some of this is arguing about rules that the United States States was part of making. At the same time, I don't think it's wrong to also point out that the WHO has been somewhat China-centric. The head of the WHO is an Ethiopian microbiologist who was China's pick for the job. He has defended China and said that they did a great job when I think reliable sources and observers in China would say that China is very unlikely to have actually released the true figures showing the scope of the coronavirus deaths there, just in terms of the funerary urns, the cremation urns that were being returned in Wuhan alone. Yeah. Those numbers outstrip their national count, and they severely undercounted and did not give credit to how Taiwan has done a really excellent job of keeping down the virus, and they don't want to give that credit because the People's Republic of China doesn't recognize Taiwan as its own entity. So there, you know, it's not entirely wrong either to, you know, give some criticism where it's due.
Arthur writes to us in an email. He says the WHO response has been totally inadequate and has been totally in bed with China. China knew in December that this virus was highly contagious from human to human and covered this fact up for weeks. If you're looking for botched jobs, look at China and the WHO. Now, Abdurrahim DGL emailed us as well. This person wants to know, who is the world leader in testing?
At this point in time, the Chinese seem to have done a lot of catching up since the whole debacle of Wuhan. There's a concerted effort in some parts of Europe. The Germans have been very effective in in this area. The Brits seem to be trying to catch up, but obviously, everybody's eyes around the world remain on what happens here in the United States. A lot of questions of why is the United States still lagging in terms of testing? And when the US starts to catch up, obviously the whole world will want to know how it's doing that, because that will provide the light for many countries around the world.
Now let's take a moment to acknowledge something more positive that's spreading across the globe. People across the world are stepping out of their homes at the same time each day and cheering for healthcare workers. Here's how that sounded in Vancouver recently. Unfortunately, in some places, healthcare workers are not being celebrated. They're being attacked. Reports from Mexico, the Philippines, and other countries describe healthcare workers being spit on and verbally and physically assaulted. They've even been warned in some parts of Australia not to wear their scrubs in public. Ishan, what's happening here? Why would people attack healthcare workers, and how widespread is this?
It's a really sad trend that we're seeing in a time of crisis, in a time of a lot of fear in various parts of the world, and indeed in a time of a lot of misinformation. And so you've seen instances where healthcare workers are coming to check on certain neighborhoods or certain families that have been traced to the virus. And the neighbors in these areas come out to chase them away. There, in the capital of the Ivory Coast, Abidjan, there was this episode where the government tried to build a testing facility, and the people in that neighborhood essentially rioted and tried to take it apart because they were afraid that if this testing facility was so close to them, they could contract the virus. So it does highlight that even at a time when medical workers are indeed making such tremendous sacrifices, giving so much of themselves and putting their lives on the risk as frontline workers in this crisis, they at the same time have to face a lot of suspicion, a degree of stigmatization in certain societies, and a degree of hostility from people who fear that they are part of some broader situation where they could contract the virus.
The European Union struck a messy compromise over coronavirus aid this week. The bloc will unlock $500 billion in EU aid for countries hit hardest by the pandemic. Indira, the aid came after a dire prediction by Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte that coronavirus could kill the EU as a concept. Now, how much of this risk of the EU's disillusion is real versus how much is posturing by the Italian Prime Minister?
I don't know that I would call it posturing, but it's not the first time that Italy and other countries who have been badly hit by an economic situation, let's not forget the, you know, the global economic crisis in 2008, Italy, Portugal, Ireland, Spain were much worse hit than other countries in the EU. And you'll recall that those other nations, the richer ones, did not want to bail them out. Germany and others weren't thrilled about, you know, plans that meant you had to bail out Greece and Italy and others. In this case, you know, this is a health crisis. It's not necessarily about bad economic decisions that were made by leaders. Some of this, let's not forget, is because Italians and Spaniards tend to live in homes where there are grandparents, multi-generational in the same household, and that's been one of the reasons that they've been really badly hit by this. But what he was talking about was the split over the issuance of these so-called corona bonds, which would mean debt sharing among Eurozone countries.
Right.
And
some refer to that as corona bonds, right? So is that in the $500 billion aid plan?
I think that the issue with the $500 billion aid plan is that there is still concern over how much it's going to be shared debt. The Netherlands, for example, was very much against that. But Conte is right that if you don't have all the nations standing together in a time of crisis like this, which no one could have predicted, yes, it could have been handled better, as we talked about with reference to the WHO and world travel, but if you time like this, what is the point of an international body like this?
Ishan, isn't this the point of the EU? You know, it would cost some countries more to borrow money now, but they make up for it in the long term by being one market. No?
This pandemic has accelerated a huge kind of philosophical debate on the continent about what the European project should be, how far should it go. You know, when the United States was coming together as a nation, the various colonies that became states eventually agreed to pool their debt together, and that's a huge part of how you build a federal state. And then there are proponents in Europe who argue that Europe needs to be more integrated, and this corona bonds concept, which is being pushed for by, yes, countries in Southern Europe that are very badly affected and also facing a huge degree of problems with their public debt, but also by France and French President Macron, who's really the figurehead of this kind of championing of a United States of Europe. What they're saying is that this is a time to really prove our unity. And this is an instrument that could really, you know, beyond helping lift devastated economies out of recessions that are starting now or have already started, it would really take Europe to another level of its integration. But it doesn't seem to be a proposal that's gained very much steam. And in this $500 billion stimulus plan that's been put forward, that's a much more conservative plan that's been put forward and agreed to. And so what we're seeing right now, less than, say, evidence of unity and solidarity in Europe, we're seeing some, as Indira pointed to, some of the old divisions remain and sort of disable the continent from taking more aggressive united action.
Let's go now to a country that is saying goodbye to the EU. The United Kingdom's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been released from the intensive care unit. He spent most of the week there after his coronavirus symptoms worsened. Now, Abderrahim, how big of a deal was this that the UK's Prime Minister was in critical condition?
It was a huge deal because, you know, it just refocused attention yet again, if it ever needed any focusing, on the fact that this is a virus that basically does not basically distinguish between people. It does not spare someone because he's prime minister.
Right, no one's exempt.
I mean, yesterday, no one's exempt. Yesterday, or the day before, we had this incredible story in the New York Times that the Saudi royal family may have been affected by the virus, and there were reports that, you know, a whole hospital was set up to deal with them. So for Boris Johnson to have been admitted to hospital because of the infection is a huge deal for Brits, but it's also a huge deal for people around the world. The fact that he was struggling to make important decisions at a critical point in time like this.
Mm-hmm.
People started turning to the Queen, obviously, when she made that that speech where she was very reassuring. So we had these two different tendencies. One of the Queen reassuring the UK and the rest of the world, but also the other one, the Prime Minister is now affected. And I suppose the fact that he's out of hospital is great news for the Brits. It's great news for President Donald Trump, because he is a close ally. And on the subject of the EU, we all know that what President Trump's position on the EU has been. He was very encouraging of Boris Johnson to actually lead the United Kingdom out of the EU, because he sees dealing with individual countries in the EU as much more beneficial for the United States than dealing with the whole bloc.
What's his current condition? Do you know?
Well, we know that he's back in the saddle, according to everything that we are hearing. What is the extent of that being in the saddle? It's still not unknown. The work of a prime minister goes without saying. Obviously, he has to deal with enormous pressures day to day. Is he able to deal with all those pressures as he was before he was admitted to the hospital? We still don't know.
Now, the first city to see the novel coronavirus has ended its lockdown. Wuhan, China, a city of 11 million people, was locked down for 76 days, starting in late January, to limit the spread of the virus. At the time, the measures seemed extreme, but Chinese authorities say they've worked. There have been no new reported cases in the city for 19 days now. Yishan, how is China monitoring the health of its citizens now that they're free to travel around the country?
Through an extensive 21st century digital surveillance program. It's a pretty fascinating look at the future. And China, of course, for a very long time has pioneered its surveillance, modern surveillance technologies through AI, facial recognition, other means. Now, to travel around, you have to have a kind of digital tracking app on your phone that monitors, that has data about your health, and that allows Chinese authorities to track your location. So part of what's emerging from this, from the ashes of the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
is, you know, the infrastructure of a new digital surveillance state. And of course, in Wuhan, there's so many questions still left unanswered, but in this past week, we've seen non-essential businesses open again. People go out into the streets again, and so for them, it's certainly a happy, you know, moment. They were at the epicenter of the outbreak for a very long time. They've suffered. We don't know how much because the Chinese figures are very questionable, but probably quite a degree of suffering and death has taken place in that city alone. And for them, it is a heartening moment. But what is emerging from this indeed also has a sharp political edge in the measures that China as an authoritarian state can take in tracking its citizens and monitoring their health going forward.
Indira, can you give us any insight as to what life is like right now for people in Wuhan? How are they adapting after being on lockdown for like 2 months?
Sure. I mean, on the one hand, I want to say that there are concerns that have already been raised about not lifting these restrictions too quickly in Wuhan. And although the government has said, you know, yes, you don't have to be on total lockdown, you know, there's movement data. You can track people through their cell phones and through, you know, traffic apps, and people are not moving as much as they had been prior. A lot of international, you know, epidemiologists and doctors are saying, please slow this down. Remember, the way China handled this from the beginning, by sort of trying to encircle Wuhan and Hebei province and then saying, but travel from the rest of China is okay, was not a great way to handle it. And as, you know, Yishan suggested, we really don't know what the full numbers are of the dead and infected in China. So I don't think we should be celebrating too prematurely. And one related point is that in the UK, where Boris Johnson is out of the intensive care unit, but he's actually still very much in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting to note that the prime minister was himself nearly a victim of this herd immunity concept that he and some of his advisors initially tried to put in the UK, which was rather than having people stay at home, trying to maintain some semblance of normal life on the notion that little by little, you know, people will, you know, some people will go down. Yes, it's sort of a survival of the fittest philosophy, but eventually we'll get herd immunity through it. So at National Geographic, we wrote a story that really looked closely at this. And while over the long term, we might need, you know, as a global entity, herd immunity against coronavirus to try to roll it out country by country, as the UK tried to do and as Sweden is trying to do, has turned out to be quite dangerous and has met high infection rates, high death rates. And as we were talking about earlier, the UK looks to be on a very terrible path that they might be going down to numbers approaching the Italians. So I think there are a lot of concerns about the way they handled it, and the fact that the prime minister himself became ill, you know, sort of held up as an example the fact that that approach was not necessarily great. And one last point to earlier in the program, you were asking us about which countries were doing the most testing. And Norway and South Korea are way, way out front in terms of, you know, testing like 6,500 people or 6,200 people per 1 million. And they are, correspondingly, they are nations that have very low infection rates because they're testing people so widely. Just to give you a contrast, in the United States, we're only testing 136 people per 1 million. You know, which is not that high above India, that's only testing 10 people
per
million.
So quickly, sticking with China, I'm just checking out an email here from Jan. She says, you know, what do we think about the loosening of restrictions there? And more importantly, would that draconian level of monitoring work here in the U.S., people being able to go out again? What do you say to that, Abdirahim?
Well, I mean, the Chinese obviously have been able to do certain things that, you know, people in or governments in the United States and the Western world would find very difficult to do. The fact that they applied serious restrictions in all manner of ways, some of them, you know, issues of restrictions on freedoms, the whole thing about transparency, how much they told the rest of the country, the country and the rest of the world about what was going on in Wuhan. And I suppose if they did it once, they would probably be able to do it again if they have to. But the fact is, they did it once, they sort of got away with it. They've even created a debate in some Western democracies, the US is not an exception, as to how much should we be able to tolerate in terms of a particular government trying to restrict our freedoms when we are facing an issue of life and death. And a lot of people, whether in Western democracies or elsewhere in the world, if they are facing an issue of life and death, I believe that they would say it's okay for the government to do what it needs to do as long as they manage to save my life. So the Chinese, whether they were actually successful 100% in doing what they tell us they've done in Wuhan or not, but that's become their narrative now, and it's widely accepted.
We're going to turn to Israel now, where Passover celebrations looked a little bit different this year. There was a curfew issued throughout the country, meaning that from 3 p.m. on Wednesday to 7 a.m. on Thursday, citizens were forced to stay inside their homes. Israel is still under a general lockdown that limits movement except for essential purposes. Officials are meeting this weekend to decide how long to extend this lockdown. Indira, how did this affect the way that people in Israel celebrated this year?
Well, this has been really striking because, of course, the purpose of it was the opening night of Passover, the first night of one of the most important Jewish holidays of the year. And the Israeli officials wanted to prevent Jews from, you know, taking this festive holiday and going to friends' houses or family's houses and potentially spreading the virus. It's not just in Israel where we've seen virtual Passover celebrated, people getting on Zooms. We've done a piece at National Geographic about people doing doing this around the world. And, you know, the striking thing is that, of course, Israel and Jerusalem specifically is one of the holiest cities for the three Abrahamic religions that have major holidays right now, right? Passover, Easter, and upcoming Ramadan. And how different the country looks right now at a time when people would be celebrating. You'd have Good Friday processions today. You'd have Easter Mass being celebrated at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And those places are having to be shut down. So this is something that we've kept a really close eye on because, you know, culture around the world is being deeply affected and shifted as a result of this pandemic, just in the way we exercise our ordinary lives. So we see it in Israel. It's some people compared it to as quiet as Yom Kippur, which is, know, a very different kind of Jewish holiday where people are repenting. So it really has had a huge effect, not just on the health, but on the practice of social customs.
And Abdir Rahim, you heard Indira mention Easter. Easter and Ramadan are coming up later this month. Have any countries announced similar curfew measures around these holidays?
So far, not. But I would imagine if the current pace of the virus continues, obviously similar measures elsewhere throughout the Middle East and the Muslim world would be expected. Obviously, every country is finding itself now in this new world, having to contend with realities that people had never thought about. Somebody sent me a picture of a square in one of the old cities in Morocco. The square is about 1,000 years old. And I would bet that square had never been so completely empty as it was last week in its 10,000 years of existence. The only thing that, told you that that town was still inhabited was the calls to prayer. Mosques have been shut to worshippers throughout North Africa and the Middle East and a lot of other places in the Muslim world. It's going to be interesting to see to what extent, if the situation continues throughout the month of Ramadan, for example, it's going to be interesting to see how that may compound the many of the difficulties that come for people trying to make a living during the month of Ramadan. Obviously, there's a lot of trade that goes on. People buy stuff in mass. With the coronavirus, I don't know what the state of the supplies will be during the month of Ramadan. People tend to stay home during the day in Ramadan in big numbers. But now, if the coronavirus continues rumbling through the month of Ramadan with its lockdowns and curfews, it's going to be interesting to see how the what the combination of the coronavirus lockdowns and Ramadan will produce.
In Syria, a chemical weapons watchdog has concluded that the nation's air force used the nerve agent sarin in 3 attacks back in March 2017. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons found that sarin gas was used on over 100 people in the village of Al-Ladamina. Now, Ishan, remind us briefly what this is all about.
Well, obviously, in 2017 and in the years before that, we have had evidence of the Syrian regime deploying these kinds of chemical weapons in its attacks on rebel-held territory and rebel-held positions, often involved in attacks on specifically civilian-dominated areas. And in the past, the Syrians, abetted by their Russian allies, have always dismissed these allegations. They have insisted that the footage we're seeing on social media of these attacks are staged by activists or fundamentalist Islamists. And they've really pushed that line for a long time, to the extent to which there's been zero kind of accountability for their actions. And of course, takes place in the context of a hideous war that's been going on and remains still in a low-level state right now. And this OPCW verdict is pretty significant because it kind of rules out the Syrian and Russian argument that these were staged. Mm-hmm. And it sets a precedent that in some future that we don't live in right now, where there can be a process to litigate for the crimes of the Syrian civil war. The perpetrators of this kind of chemical attack won't necessarily be able to hide behind impunity.
Last year, Australian Cardinal George Pell was convicted on 5 counts of child sex abuse. Earlier this week, Cardinal Pell walked free when Australia's High Court unanimously overturned his conviction. Indira, refresh our memories. What was Cardinal Pell convicted of, and why was this conviction so historic?
Right. In 2018, a jury in Australia convicted him of abusing 2 choir boys in the 1990s. And one of those gentlemen, who is referred to now just as Witness J, had given evidence. The other one had already since passed away. And what was interesting was in the whole trial process, Cardinal Pell's lawyers did not try to discredit the testimony from Witness J, but they said that other evidence had not been properly considered. And Cardinal Pell, it was very significant to have someone of such a high rank in the Catholic Church actually convicted of pedophilia, of sex crimes against young children. That was a first. And then he took this all the way to the High Court, and the High Court basically said, they vacated the conviction by saying that the jury had not considered other evidence enough, so now he's walked free after 400 days. What, the witness in question has basically said that he wants to reassure child sex abusers that most people recognize the truth when they hear it. And very strikingly, I thought, was that the Pope, who, was close to Cardinal Pell. Cardinal Pell was, one of his key advisors. Mm-hmm. Pope Francis essentially offered a morning mass that day for those suffering from unjust sentences. So clearly a reference to his support for Cardinal Pell, which a lot of people in the survivor community did not take kindly to, because they felt that with everything that the Catholic Church has been slow to react, insensitive to, covering up, crimes of pedophilia by priests, for the Pope to then come out, charging, defending this cardinal, rather than saying something on behalf of victims and survivors, was not taken well by those survivors.
Abdirahim, is this a win for the Catholic Church? Can we expect to see them use this to defend other church leaders that have been accused of assault, or is this a one-off case?
It's probably a bit of both. I mean, it will enable the Catholic Church to continue to defend other cases, but it's also a reminder of the various challenges that the Catholic Church continues to face in Australia and in other parts of the world, including here in the United States, in places like Boston, for example. Mm-hmm. But obviously, what's interesting about this is that it comes in the middle of this coronavirus situation, where people are looking up to, priests and imams, and they're looking up to the religious authorities, wherever they may be, whether they're Christian, Jewish, Muslim, whatever, to help bring people together. And to, once the virus is defeated, to help heal the wound of the coronavirus situation. And in this sense, this is probably another challenge that the Catholic Church will continue to face through the coronavirus situation and in the post-coronavirus period.
Now, before we run out of time, we just wanted to take some time to end the Friday Roundup, giving our journalists a chance to tell their stories about, what they've been working on, what they've been thinking about, maybe even stories that they think might not be on our radar, but they should. I'll start with you, Indira. Briefly, can you tell us, what are you keeping an eye on?
We are looking at a lot of the connections between animals and coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And so one of our reporters really broke and started with this story about the tiger testing positive for coronavirus at the Bronx Zoo. At the same time, our reporters are looking at how it's very unlikely that you can get coronavirus from your house pets. So trying to tamp down some of those urban legends that are not true. It's different from human to animal transmission, which is very rare. But we don't have really cases of cats or dogs giving it to people. But I want to sort of, for people who might be tired of coronavirus stories. Mm-hmm. I also want to sort of direct attention to other stories that we're doing. We're trying to remind people about the great outdoors, sort of virtual around the world in 80 books when you're stuck at home, but that's another way to travel. Appreciating the great outdoors. Our photographers around the world are doing dispatches. And then our April issue is focused on Earth Day. And we have done this really revolutionary thing with a flip cover. One side imagines the Earth in 50 years mm-hmm. if we actually get control of climate change. The other side says, what if we don't? And I really would encourage people to take a look at that on NationalGeographic.com because there are other things we should be thinking about beyond this pandemic.
Right.
Once we get through it,
yes.
Larger problems we have to
so
solve.
So much more happening. But of course, this is dominating the news cycle at this time. Ishan, I want to make sure you tell us what you're working on. What's up next?
Well, I write a daily foreign affairs column called Today's Worldview, which I urge the listeners to subscribe to online. It comes as a free newsletter. My last column this morning was involved an interview with Andrew Yang, the former presidential candidate, and we were talking about the resurgence of discussion around UBI, universal basic income, mm-hmm. in the shadow of the pandemic. You're seeing, say, in Spain, for example, this week, the Spanish government is formulating plans to roll out, as the first European country, a form of basically a monthly checks to every, to if not every citizen in the country, to a vast proportion of the Spanish population. And we're seeing, you know, as we were discussing earlier, the coronavirus may be a great leveler biologically. Anyone can get it. But economically, it's not. Mm-hmm. And what the pandemic has done, it's created a situation where it's exposed the frailties of so many rich societies, the precariousness with which so many people who, you know, live paycheck to paycheck or sort of are in sort of vulnerable gig economies.
Yeah.
And this situation has led many politicians, not just Andrew Yang, to suggest that a future where a guaranteed level of basic income can reach people may be the most just and sensible economically going forward.
Just 20 seconds to go, Abdirahim. What's next at Al Jazeera?
Well, one of the things that we've been doing, which is only indirectly related to the coronavirus situation, is we've been trying to look at the U.S. Census 2020.
Okay.
And what it means for various minorities, including Arab Americans, given the fact that, you know, federal funding goes to things like healthcare for in certain instances for minorities. So we're looking at that.
A big thanks to my guests, Abdirahim Fukara. He's the chief of Al Jazeera's U.S. Bureau. Abdirahim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Indira Lakshmanan is National Geographic's senior executive editor. Indira, always a pleasure.
Thank you so much. You too.
Ishan Tharoor covers foreign affairs for The Washington Post. Ishan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and I hope everyone stays safe.
Absolutely. Before we go, time for today's act of kindness. Today's story comes from Stefan, a long-distance truck driver delivering food across the U.S. and into Canada.
Twice during the early April, I was at rest areas in Oklahoma and Texas and had perfect strangers drive up with a trunk full of groceries and hand them to me. They were washed fruit and all kinds of stuff and said, no strings attached, we just wanted to say thank you for keeping everything moving. It's the first time I've ever had that happen. And I drive for 2 months at a time and go home for a week for normally a job is pretty thankless.
Wow, proof that the worst of times can really bring out the best in us. Well, Stefan, we do want to thank you for sharing your story and for keeping us fed and supplied, of course, during this pandemic. Please try to stay safe out there. If you have an act of kindness to share with us, we would love to hear it. Our number is 855-236-1212. We read and listen to every single one of them. The number again is 855-236-1212. Our senior producers are Danielle Knight and Paige Osborne. We also want to give a special shout out to Al Reynolds, Andy Gunn, and Rob Bertrand, who are working day and night developing technological marvels that are keeping us and this whole station on the air. A big thanks from all of us here at 1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks so much for listening. This is 1A.